Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. I last interviewed the writer Danny Fingeroth on the release of his book about the great comic book impresario, Stan Lee. For Fingeroth's next book, he chose a very different subject, Jack Ruby, the assassin of the assassin of President Kennedy. Fingeroth's book, Jack Ruby, was published in November 2023 by Chicago Review Press. I asked him what led him to the subject.
I was 10 years old when Kennedy was assassinated, and then 2 days later, Oswald was murdered by Jack Ruby. And I'd always had a certain amount of interest in it, but it sort of seemed too big for me. It just like a million conspiracy theories, and this might have happened, and that person might have been behind it, and all these different cultural references that you would see, you know, all the time, because it was a major traumatic event. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, around the 50th anniversary, I started thinking more in depth about it. Specifically, I was going to do a graphic novel project, and that didn't happen, but it evolved into the prose biography that came out. And in that period of learning, of reading and studying about the assassination and the people involved in it, I developed something of an obsession with it, and specifically with Jack Ruby, who was a first-generation American-born son of Eastern European Jewish immigrants, much like my parents, aunts, and uncles, and much like the creators of the comic book industry. So that's always sort of been a focus of mine and an obsession of mine, is people from that background, sort of the contrast of like, well, here's my family and my social circle and people I know who mostly did kind of more traditional things. And then here are some people who in oddly different ways really changed the course of history.
It's so interesting because your last book, and we talked with you on this podcast about your last book, because you've been steeped in the comics industry for so many decades. So this was a big departure for you on the face of it to write a book like this. How was it different to research a book like this? Because it wasn't a subject that was innately baked into you as the comics industry was as a career for so many years.
Well, exactly, because the comics, I lived both as a fan and as a professional in the comic book business. So I was sort of, without knowing it, researching it all along. And then when it came time to write, you know, not just the Stan Lee biography, but also several other nonfiction books about the history of comics and the psychology of comics and Jews in comics, that was stuff I knew intuitively and instinctively, and I knew who to go to and who to ask and what to take with a grain of salt and what to take at face value. And because I had worked inside the business, I knew how the sausage was made in comics. So a lot of it was second nature to me. For this stuff, that was a combination. You know, it was well-known history, and yet there's been 1,000 at least, you know, books written about the Kennedy assassination from dozens of different viewpoints, and a couple of books about Ruby, but nothing for a long time. You know, there was a book about the Ruby trial a couple of years ago, a terrific book, but that focused on the trial. Mm-hmm. So I had to research this. I was an insider in the sense that, you know, because of that interest in that generation of Jewish Americans, I had obviously my family, friends, self, but when you get in to the Kennedy assassination, there's so many rabbit holes and so many minefields and so many people with different agendas. And it's a history that is unbelievably documented, you know, with millions of papers and photos and interviews. And yet the things that are most urgent for people to know, which is what really, quote unquote, really happened, who did what. There is so much assumption and supposition and kind of reasoning and logic, but there's no picture of Oswald shooting.
Yes,
There's no
right.
lack of lack of pictures of Jack Ruby shooting. So I was very naive, especially when I, when I started it out as a graphic novel project 10 or 12 years ago. I kind of figured by focusing on Ruby, I could maybe sidestep a lot of the side corridors and rabbit holes of conspiracy. But of course, that was highly naive on my part. When I first went into this, the thing I had, and that I think still makes my book fairly unique, is I had access to a guy named Hillel Silverman, who was Jack's rabbi in Dallas. And so I knew people who knew him, and he only died about 6 months ago at age 99. And so I interviewed him, and he also offered me access to the copious notes he took while visiting Jack Ruby in prison. Like everybody in that room, in that courtroom, he was writing a book, which he never did write. In his own memoir, he had like a couple of pages about Ruby, but he never made use of those extensive notes. And so he said, "Would you like to see my notes from visiting Jack in prison?" I said, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind." And so I get a FedEx package with these notes from 1963, complete with the rusty paper clips from decades ago. And they were
Wow.
very detailed. And so I can't claim I'm the only one who's seen them, but I think I'm the only one who made as extensive use as I did, sort of intercutting them with the trial transcript and newspaper accounts and Ruby himself. I mean, the one of the strange things, Oswald, of course, all we have on record of Oswald in the 2 days that he lived between the two killings was those things he said in the impromptu news conferences that were really just to show that he wasn't being beaten too badly, but there was no functioning tape recorder in the Dallas Police Department, which strikes me, that seems like a prescription for conspiracy theory. My family, we weren't wealthy, but we had a tape recorder in 1963, and a lot of people had tape recorders in 1963. So Oswald, there's a limit to what he said on the record and in front of cameras or tape recorders. Jack Ruby spent 3 years not shutting up. Jack Ruby would talk to anybody and everybody. He had impromptu news conferences during the recesses in the trial. He did not testify. I think his lawyers were afraid he would, obviously he was seen on television. He shot Oswald on live television. There's no doubt that he did it. But the question is, what was his state of mind, and was it premeditated? There were a lot of kind of legal fine points that could have meant the difference between life and death for Ruby. But he's a guy you couldn't shut up for 3 years, and yet the things he said contradicted the things he said the day before. So having the rabbi's notes and sort of contrasting what he recorded or what he noted down as Ruby saying to him compared to the things Ruby would say. I certainly was fascinated with Ruby. I'd say I naively ascribed to him certain motives when I was first studying it, that he wanted to be the Jew that killed the guy that killed the president and be a hero. And that's certainly one possible set of motives, but you can't rule out that he too may have been working on someone else's behalf. But there's no, I have never seen any proof definitively. And yet his contacts were such and his background was such that you can't rule it out. But both he and Oswald had lifetime histories of erratic, crazy behavior because they were nuts. Whether they were lone nuts will always be the issue. Spoiler alert, I do not solve the Kennedy assassination.
I wanted to steer us back to focusing on something you said a couple of minutes ago was really important for the nature of this conversation. And that is that you went into this thinking that, as many of us do, that if you're going to do a slice of life biography rather than a comprehensive investigation analysis of the Kennedy assassination and all the attendant parts, that maybe that kind of assignment, self-assignment is what most of us do, is going to be more manageable than writing that 10,000-page tome. You know, same thing, maybe second only to the assassination is Lincoln, right? 16,000 books or something have been written about Lincoln, every permutation of Lincoln. And they're all different. And in your case, you were zeroing in on this very specific area. And yet, when you started to research, and I'm just trying to bring you back to the research,
Sure.
less about than the conspiracy and all of
Sure.
that, the research that one needs for even a slice of life is just as broad. The knowledge you needed was just as broad as if you were writing the comprehensive 10,000 page or whatever it was about the assassination. So tell me how you prepared to write that and winnowed what you had down. Maybe not specifically what you winnowed down, but how you went about lassoing up this enormous body of knowledge to paint a portrait of somebody who really most of us know very, very little about.
Well, the approach I figured out fairly early on was, you're right. There are literally millions of documents. There are more being released every year. There are some they say they'll never release. I decided to really go as personal a route as I could. I kind of wanted to take the point of view of imagine you're watching TV. There's just been this national trauma. The president has been assassinated. And then the guy accused, the presumed accused assassin is being paraded in front of cameras again to show that he's not been beaten up, and they're escorting him from one jurisdiction to another. Imagine if your craziest cousin stepped up and killed him. So that was the point of view I tried to take. Imagine if one's craziest relative suddenly walked into history and changed it. Ruby was one of eight siblings. How does that affect your brothers and sisters watching TV like everybody in the country was and going, "Oh my God, what did Jack do now? Oh my God."
Right.
We knew he was impulsive. We knew he was violent. What the hell is he doing? And how are we going to save him from the electric chair? So I interviewed a niece and a nephew who heretofore had not been very, forthcoming. His family was in general not eager to speak to the press. I interviewed the son of one of his rival strip club owners in Dallas, and that was sort of a, that was one of the many subcultures that Ruby belonged to, was the show business world. It's funny, I used an interview that Gabe Kaplan had done on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast about auditioning for Ruby. And then, strangely enough, Gabe Kaplan showed up when I was speaking at the Dallas Jewish Historical Society last month about the book. And so I've been speaking to him and getting, even more details about that weirdness. So since I'm not setting myself the task of solving the Kennedy assassination, maybe this is an inappropriate expression in this case, how do I get up close and personal to Jack Ruby and see what this guy was about? And that's really a lot of what the trial focused on, and a lot of the coverage, although there was this steady background hum of, was it a conspiracy? Was it not? Was it the Russians? Was it the CIA? Was it the mob? Was it a combination? Was The trial itself focused more on who was this weird guy, Jack Ruby, and what was his relationship with the strippers who worked in his nightclub, and with the comedians, and with the Dallas Jewish community. I mean, it was very, I think, like I said, there was this constant background hum of conspiracy throughout the whole country and in the trial. But the trial itself and everybody who talked to Ruby and the visits from the rabbi were really about much more personal things and about his very tempestuous relationship with his siblings, especially his sister Eva, who lived in Dallas. But for me, it was interesting to hear, say from his nephew, who had been very reticent about speaking. And I think a lot of his nieces and nephews have never spoken. They didn't want to have that be defining their lives. So imagine you're 12 years old, you live in Dallas, your name is Ruby. You've been telling all your friends that your uncle owns a strip club because you're 12 years old and your uncle owns a strip club. And suddenly that uncle shows up and kills Lee Harvey Oswald on television, and then 2 days later you have to go back to school. How does that affect your life? So that was, I was trying to get insights into this guy who wasn't just that famous photo or even
Right.
that footage. He was a person, he was in show business. He was the last person to give Hank Williams regular work when Hank Williams was sort of on a downward spiral. Jack Ruby gave him work. I mean, and I don't want to make him out to be a saint. He was actually much sleazier, and had a much darker existence. I sort of imagined he was kind of like a slightly more violent Ralph Cramden, just because of the way he was built.
I wanted to ask about another thing you mentioned spurred for me, the idea that you're writing this book now, 60 years after the fact. And let's talk about the place and time in history in which we as biographers tell the stories that we tell. In many ways, as I was reading your book, it occurred to me that the book you wrote probably couldn't have been written any sooner than it was now because of a thousand different reasons. History needs time to bake and change, and maybe someone couldn't have done, well, you needed to write this story, obviously, but somebody couldn't have come along and done this story probably much sooner than now. For all sorts of reasons. Do you think that that's correct about this whole notion of when we write stories, how important it is, the time in which we tell them?
Well, I think anything that's written, no matter whether it's fiction or nonfiction, whenever it's set, is as much or more about the time it's written in, because that's the time you live in. So you can try to imagine yourself in a previous time, or since I was alive then, I can try to sort of remember what it felt like. But I was 10 years old, so I certainly did not have any of the consciousness that a teenager or an adult or a middle-aged person would have back then. I think sort of maybe the audience. Nobody has really written much about Ruby in the past 40 or 50 years, with the exception of that book by Dan Abrams and Fisher about the trial. But I think as the baby boom generation gets older and wants to sort of make a permanent record of some kind and some kind of interpretive record for itself and for generations to come. Because I think, while you would think, well, how much can younger people be interested in the Kennedy assassination and Jack Ruby? Maybe not everybody, but I think there are a lot of people looking for clues and signposts. How do we get here today? How do we get to this whole world of conspiracy culture? How do we get to QAnon and all that stuff? And I think that, there's always been conspiracy culture preceding, but I think the Kennedy assassination really kick-started it and put it in people's minds. So, I think there are certain things. You're right. We're at a certain point in history where looking back on Ruby and his world can hopefully be informative and maybe have some educational value and some value of people reflecting on history. So, it does seem that there is quite a bit of interest in I've seen in the book from people across a wide variety of ages. It's funny, you mentioned Lincoln's assassination and of course Kennedy's. Somehow, McKinley and Garfield, who also got assassinated, don't generate that kind of passion. But there is something about, people look back, even people who weren't born then, look back on the Kennedy years as that sort of Camelot myth. And it does seem pivotal to a lot of things. It's not 200 years ago that we can't relate to it. 60 years is on the one hand, it's a long time. On the other hand, it's a blink of an eye in history.
Right. And as I read your book and as I'm talking to you now, I'm thinking that down the road, children who are just born today, who didn't grow up with the specter of it in their backgrounds, as so many of us alive today have, will have a whole different take on the event and the subsequent events. And you've contributed to the historical record with what you've done. So that must feel pretty good.
It's it's surreal. It's you as a biographer yourself, that sort of you throw this stone into this water of history, and then you don't really know how it's going to ripple. It's sort of gratifying that it does. Then you sort of feel this responsibility, like, ooh, what did I
Right. Yeah.
do? What if,
Wow. Danny, this is super. I am so grateful for your time. I think this is
Oh, thank you.
perfect. So you're so articulate about all this, which I knew.
Well, you're
That's
pretty
great.
articulate yourself, so it takes one to know one.
And we're a good team. Excellent. You have to write another book so we can do this again soon.
And you too. All right. Well, that's my plan. So.
Good. Me too. I'm working on it. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, dear.
Okay, thanks. Bye bye.
Bye. That's Danny Fingeroth, author of Jack Ruby, The Many Faces of Oswald's Assassin, released in November 2023 by Chicago Review Press. I spoke with him via Zoom on December 18th, 2023. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles. Alani Hodge created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening and have a great day.